Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, everybody. We got a great one today. You know, for a change, and that makes two in a row. Last week, we had Ben Wickler, the Wisconsin Democratic State Chair, a spectacular one. And this week, Andrew Weissman and Melissa Murray on the Trump trial going on in Manhattan. Two brilliant ones in a row. That's happened once before. 4 years ago, we had Norm Ornstein on the filibuster, and the next week, Howard Fineman on Mitch McConnell, back to back. And I never believed we could match that again, but here we are. Here we are. This one takes us into the prosecution of Donald Trump. A tawdry case, as you know. It involves an alleged tryst with adult film actress Stormy Daniels, but more important, the alleged payoff of $130,000 and the falsification of documents to cover that up, and an alleged 11-month affair with playmate Karen McDougal and her payoff and alleged falsification of that. There's a lot of wrinkles in this case. Trump says he will testify. He won't, but he'll have to sit there every day and keep quiet, which has been a problem. The judge chastised him for joining with a prospective juror, and Trump put out something on Truth Social saying that prospective jurors were undercover agents trying to get on the jury, and Judge Merchan scolded him for that. That is a tension in the trial, whether Judge Merchan is going to have to punish him with home confinement for a weekend or even a timeout in a holding cell, which they have in the courthouse. I'm thinking one of those is inevitable, but we shall see. This is a fascinating one. It evidently makes no difference. It makes no difference whether Trump had sex with these women. He paid them off and then falsified documents in order to cover it up. And that's where the felony occurs, falsifying business records. Whether or not he had sex with the two women, which of course he did, but that's not, you know, that's just my opinion. But come on. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. He paid them off and then falsified the documentation, and that's the felony. Murray and Weissman have written the New York Times bestseller on all four criminal cases against Trump titled The Trump Indictments, which contains charging documents with commentary. So in addition to the Stormy Daniels hush money trial, we talk about the Supreme Court slow walking the immunity issue, which they've used to delay the January 6th trial. They are hearing that case on the last possible day of this court term. Long and short, this will most likely be the only Trump trial before the election. SCOTUS bastards. Anyway, war between Israel and Iran with Hezbollah joining in. Oh, boy. May you live in dangerous and sleazy times. We got Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman. A truly great one. You know. For a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Taping this on Thursday, April 18th. It'll be dropping on Sunday, so possibly by then, the entire jury selection process will be completed, or we'll be down to zero or something like that. We've had one drop out, and also another was dismissed, right?
Right. It's definitely two steps forward, one step back.
I remember the judge thought that maybe this could be done by Friday, but that's probably doubtful right now.
He spoke too soon.
So now we're down to five. Explain the voir dire process from the standpoint of a jury, a prospective juror. Does the juror come in one at a time? Is that how it goes?
So because this is a high-profile matter, this is probably a little different from what some listeners may have experienced when they have shown up to do civil or criminal jury selection. There is just a lot more questioning because you're really trying to ferret out those people who, because it's so high profile, have preconceived views about the case and can't put those aside. You're also worried about the people who are trying to sort of sneak on the jury, mm-hmm. who might be less than candid about their views.
That seems to be the second one.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a real problem in high profile matters. You know, most people aren't waking up saying, I can't wait to do jury service. But in high profile matters, you do have that problem of people who want to get on. So what the judge is doing here is he takes a group of people, which in the business is called a sort of veneer, and he asks them all a lot of these preliminary questions to ferret out people who need to be struck for cause.
So let me get a picture of this. A group comes into the courtroom. Is that right?
Yep.
And they see Donald Trump. Is that the first time they realize they're being interviewed for the Trump trial?
Exactly. And one of the jurors who's been excused, the potential jurors, has said that, you know, said it was sort of stunning to suddenly be there and realize, oh, this was the case.
I can only imagine. I mean, your heart must either sink, I guess. I don't know. It must be a weird. So imagine that. Just imagine you walk in, you have jury duty, you're wondering what you're going to get, and then you walk in and there's Trump.
Yeah, but that is one of the great things about this country is that is the way the criminal justice system and the civil justice system, when you have a right to a trial for by jury, that's the way it works. Is that everyday citizens come in, hear the facts, are told what the law is that needs to be applied, and they decide what happens. Yes, obviously there's the highest level people who held the most exalted positions in government, and there's everyday people who are being held to account in civil matters and everything in between. And that is really a great thing about our democracy is the jury system. And my experience, I don't know if you've been on a jury, is that I have not. And I think people really, by and large, really rise to the occasion and really take mm-hmm. it seriously and really want to accord due process and justice and are very exacting, as they should be, whether it's a civil or criminal case.
Can I add a slight gloss to this, though, Al?
Yes.
You know, when you get in New York City, when you get your jury duty form, your notice that you've been called for jury duty, you get a set of dates where, you know, you have to present yourself. And I think unless you've been under a rock, you know that the Trump trial is starting in downtown Manhattan on a particular day. The thing is, I think what Andrew's point is that there are still other trials. Donald Trump is like any other defendant who is going to trial this week. And so when you present yourself for jury duty, it could be for Donald Trump or it could be for some other anodyne criminal case that's going forward. So I think the surprise is that, oh, wow, I got the big one as opposed to some of the more anodyne cases. But I think most people in New York knew that this was starting on April 15th.
Okay, let's talk about the case. In your book, you basically say that this alone of the four indictments is the most questionable case. Explain that.
So I don't know that we necessarily say that it's questionable, but we do think that it is built on what might be viewed as an unorthodox legal theory. And that is to say that the principal charge here that Alvin Bragg has filed against Donald Trump is that he's falsified business records. So ordinarily, a falsification of business records charge is a misdemeanor charge in New York State. However, when the falsification of business records is done in furtherance of some other crime, it can be elevated to the level of a felony charge. And so what has happened here is that Alvin Bragg has charged the falsification of business records in conjunction with the furtherance of what appears to be a series of other crimes, among them a federal election fraud violation, a state level election fraud violation, and maybe some state level tax level violations. And this is sort of speculative. We'll know more as the trial proceeds.
What do you mean it's questionable? He doesn't in the charging documents say which ones are the second one?
He sort of gestures toward them in the bill of particulars, but like I think the actual specificity of which charges are being brought in conjunction with the falsification charges is going to come out at trial. The question though, and what makes this questionable is like there are real, I think, questions about what kinds of charges can be bootstrapped to a state level falsification of business records charge in order to elevate it to a felony. It may be the case that the New York legislature, and I think it could be argued that the New York legislature didn't intend for federal charges to be the crime that was being furthered by the falsification of business records.
Okay, so this will go to appeal immediately if he gets convicted.
Well, it might go to appeal and like it might be appealed in the middle of the trial. I mean, you may have a genuine defense motion that is raised that you cannot actually bring this felony charge because the theory of the felony is improper because, you know, Alvin Bragg has linked this to a federal charge.
So what happens then? Does that interrupt the trial? No, that just
I don't think so. I think they will go to a verdict, but he gets to raise that on appeal as an issue because the district judge, the Judge Marchand, has said that with respect to three of the four theories that make this a felony, those can go to the jury. But as to all three, Donald Trump, if he's convicted, would have the same rights that anyone else would to raise those legal issues. But right now, there are at least three theories that Alvin Bragg has for why these are felonies and not misdemeanors. And he only has to win as to one of those.
Okay.
One of the beauties of our system is Donald Trump, like any other defendant, is both entitled to the presumption of innocence. And Alvin Bragg has to prove his case beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury. It's his burden to, and we'll see if he carries it with respect to any of those three theories.
Well, prosecution is calling a lot of witnesses, including, of course, Stormy Daniels, who says that she and Trump had a tryst, which he denies. And Karen McDougal, the Playboy model, who says that she had an 11-month affair with Trump or 10-month, which he also denies.
You know, one thing to keep focused on is that it is actually not required to show whether any of that actually happened. The issue is whether he was keeping that information from the public through false business records. In other words, if you're Donald Trump, you're like, you know what, whether or not the affair happened, I don't want that information out. In fact, with respect to the allegations with respect to a doorman, I think that the state's position is that the doorman's allegations are in fact false, but that still was information that Donald Trump did not want out. And so he engaged in this catch and kill.
Catch and kill is a term of art, and that's what happened with the National Enquirer and Karen McDougal.
Exactly. That is what's alleged with respect to her. It's what's alleged with respect to Stormy Daniels, which is that this is an effort that Donald Trump, with the complicity of the National Enquirer, was keeping damaging information, particularly with respect to Ms. Daniels, right after the Access Hollywood tape, which gave a huge motive for Donald Trump to make sure that there were not going to be any more damaging stories that could tear away from the picture that he was presenting to the public. Remember, he was running sort of as a Bible-thumping, evangelical-loving guy who was going to get rid of Roe v. Wade. And then, in fact, if this information is true, it was going to present him as an amoral, hedonistic billionaire who was presenting a false picture of both himself and, according to the DA, a false picture of his adversaries with the complicity of the National Enquirer.
It's interesting because these evangelicals seem to stuck with him even after this information came out.
Yes.
But, okay, so this is called the Stormy Daniels Hush Money Trial. Why is it not the Stormy Daniels Karen McDougal Hush Money Trial?
So the Karen McDougal allegations occur earlier than the Stormy Daniels allegations. And one of the things sort of interesting here is the statute of limitations on some of these charges. One argument that you'll hear is that the Stormy Daniels charges are too late in time. But in fact, during the pandemic, Andrew Cuomo, who's the governor of New York, issued an executive order that essentially told the statute of limitations for criminal investigations because these investigations couldn't happen because people were sheltering in place. You couldn't actually do investigative work. So it essentially added about a year and some days to the clock. And so the Stormy Daniels charges just squeak in under the wire for this new statute of limitations, but the Karen McDougal charges are too far out to be included in this indictment. So the Karen McDougal discussion is in the indictment mainly as corroboration to sort of show a pattern in practice for what later happens with Stormy Daniels.
I got it. Now, Michael Cohen will be testifying against his former boss. That will be dramatic, right?
Absolutely. You know, it always is. I mean, I've seen that whether it's in Enron or organized crime cases where you have somebody who is formerly working in the alleged conspiracy who is now on the stand. And, you know, that's how you, if you're a prosecutor, that's how you make these cases. I mean, the sort of traditional argument that's made in closing is, you know, we'd love to call priests mm-hmm. and rabbis and nuns to the stand, but that's not who's committing crimes with the defendant. And so, you know, that's why you have a Michael Cohen. But I think one of the things you're going to hear from the state is, as much as the defense wants to say this is a case about Michael Cohen versus Donald Trump, I don't think the proof is going to come out that way. I think that there is going to be a case where the star witness are the documents, and there's just going to be a host of other witnesses, including David Pecker.
Who's from the National Enquirer. He's the CEO of AMI, is that it?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. The sort of the umbrella company for the National Enquirer, and then a host of other witnesses. So I think there will be substantial corroboration. I don't think that the state would have brought this case if they thought it hinged on Michael Cohen. On the other hand, as somebody who is inside the scheme, I think he will be an important narrator for the state to give additional information and bits and pieces of information. But I would keep your eye on other witnesses and a lot of documents that will corroborate what he has to say.
Hope Hicks is a witness. What's that about?
So that's actually, I think, going to be one of the more interesting aspects of the trial, finding out what exactly Hope Hicks has to offer here. I imagine that her testimony will go to sort of the mood in the interior of Trump world after the Access Hollywood tape was divulged in October of 2016, because that's sort of the pivotal moment that animates this desire to keep these other alleged extramarital trysts from the voting public, that Trump has been so hobbled by the disclosure of the Access Hollywood tapes that in order to keep these evangelicals and other Christian or religious voters on side, that you really have to keep this other information sequestered. And that is what prompts the payments of these hush money installments to the various individuals.
So did he seek them out? Is that it? Or did Cohen seek them out? Did Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal?
That may be what we find out from Hope Hicks, like who does the approach? Does is it brought to Trump's attention? And then he dispatches his alleged fixer, Michael Cohen. I think that's a big part of what we'll learn.
And there's some reason to think that Hope Hicks comes in and out of some of the meetings with Mr. Pecker and Mr. Cohen and Donald Trump. So she is really an interesting person to keep an eye on. She, by all accounts, seems to have distanced herself from sort of the Trump camp since she left the White House.
So she's not a hostile witness or...
I don't think she will be, but it remains to be seen. But, you know, sometimes a hostile witness for the government can be some of the most devastating if they're sort of locked in because the jury sees that they really don't want to be there, that they really don't want to hurt the defendant. And yet, if they say things that are damaging, it can carry extra weight precisely because they are sort of aligned and or were aligned with the defense team. So those kinds of witnesses, and there are other sort of lesser names, less well-known names that people who worked in the Trump organization who may fit that same bill. Remember, this is the team that did the Trump organization tax case about a year and a half ago. It was a criminal case. There was a conviction.
Yeah, let's talk about the lawyers for both sides. Who are the prosecutors?
Yeah, so it's almost the same criminal team. They're very experienced, very good trial lawyers, and they know very well how to both use hostile witnesses and also get in and out. The sort of slim to win strategy, which I think is a real sign of an experienced prosecutor that, you know, you cut what you do not need. You don't overtry your case. One of the defense lawyers I know not very well, but I've dealt with her both as a defense lawyer and when I was a prosecutor and she was a defense lawyer, Susan Necklace.
Necklace?
Susan Necklace, N-E-C-H-E-L-E-S. Mm-hmm. Very well known in New York, just very well respected defense lawyer. I have some good and bad, which is I think she's really good. She knows her way around the courtroom. She's ethical. That's the good. And the bad is that Donald Trump seems to not be using her. Indeed, yeah. She is not even signing some of the filings, which is something I have never seen on the defense side.
So she's on the defense team and she's not signing some of the documents or...
Exactly. So some motions that were made with respect to Michael Cohen, she did not sign. That is basically, this is just my intuiting, that she is saying, I'm not losing my bar license over this. I am not going to make allegations that I cannot support.
Oh my God.
That's just me intuiting that because I have never seen that before.
Well, here's another sort of suggestion that, or something that may gesture toward, you know, how this is, there's some sort of internecine warfare among the defense lawyers. Susan Necklace is often removed from Todd Blanche and Donald Trump and Emile Bove, who it has been reported are actually like really engaged in conversation every morning, sort of as the trial gets started. And she's a little more to the side. And so, you know, I thought that was unusual. I think layered with what Andrew has noted about her, what seems to be a refusal to sign on to some of the filings, like, you know, we're getting a picture of maybe how this team is working or not.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman, authors of The Trump Indictments.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's what happens when you give Grammarly to your entire team. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Let's go to the facts of the case. Again, what Cohen's testimony is going to be, and what Stormy Daniels' testimonies are going to be, and what Karen McDougal's. This is tawdry, but go ahead.
I have to say, you know, there's a tawdry aspect to it, but I actually think the big picture is one where people think, oh, we know everything that's going to come out. I don't think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think that we are going to learn that this is ground zero of fake news. I think that the evidence is going to show Donald Trump engaging in a scheme to make sure that the information about him is false and rosy, and the information about his opponents is false and
well, certainly that's denigrated. What the National Enquirer did.
Exactly. And I think just to give you some examples of what the DA says they're going to present is that with respect to the National Enquirer, they gave a preview to Donald Trump of the headlines they were going to run with respect to his adversaries so that he could edit them and review them. Mm-hmm. That is sort of shocking, the idea that a media outlet, even if you don't have a high opinion of the National Enquirer, would do that on behalf of and with in complicity with one news organization.
I don't think anyone will be shocked, really.
Oh, I think they won't be shocked because we have seen that in the connection with the Dominion and Fox suit that right. followed on with this. But it really, I think we shouldn't get inured to that, that is what is happening with our media.
Let's explain the basics of the case, which is basically the two women say they had sex with him in Stormy Daniels' case once, I guess, a tryst, yep. Mm-hmm. And with Karen McDougal, an affair. Did Cohen contact both of them or either of them? No, Cohen didn't contact McDougal at all. She fell into the catch and kills category.
She went to the Enquirer and then allegedly Pecker reported it back to Trump and Cohen that this was on the radar.
And then the key is really Daniels, because after Access Hollywood broke, there was, according to the DA, essentially a frenzy to suddenly reach back out to Stormy Daniels to say, okay, we need to pay you money to keep this quiet. And that this was now an effort to not have any more bad news come out that could exacerbate the problems of the Access Hollywood tape. And I think we're going to get some insight at the trial about what was happening internal to the campaign at that point and efforts to squash negative information about Donald Trump, to disseminate false information about other people. I mean, I remember just from the Mueller investigation, the information that came out within hours of the Access Hollywood tape about the Hillary Clinton campaign leaked by WikiLeaks. There was a real effort to change the subject mm-hmm. So that people would basically look over here and not over here.
Stormy Daniels is paid $130,000, right?
Yeah, and you know, so this is Michael Cohen has to take out a home equity loan to pay it. And the specific nature of the crime is he is repaid both that money and then some for his services
Because it's going to be reported as taxable.
Well, it gets reported as income. And so there's a gross up so that he's made whole.
So they double, they basically double the 130.
And then give him some profit for his services. And it's those checks and those filings, which are alleged to have occurred while Donald Trump was president. Indeed, the allegations are that he was doing this while he was in the Oval. Those were false because they were alleged to be legal payments when, in fact, they were just reimbursement of the hush money payments that were made by Michael Cohen. That's the allegation.
So hence why this is a felony.
Exactly.
Right.
Because it's in support of the other charges. Is that right? Is it just that one has to be related to the other?
In order for this to go from a misdemeanor to a felony, the false business records have to be either concealing or in furtherance of some other crime. And so here, as we were noting, the various other crimes include a federal election scheme, a state election law scheme, or simply the tax fraud.
The tax fraud seems pretty clear.
Very clear, because it's so, by knowing that you have to double the amount of money, there's you know that Michael Cohen is going to make a false filing. Now, in the oddity is that he probably has to pay, is paying more taxes than he's actually owed, but it is still a crime. You cannot make a false filing. And it seems really obvious if you're paying more, you're doing that because there's going to be a false filing. And the reason there's going to be a false filing is to keep this hushed up. The reason it has to be called legal fees is because sure. You don't want to write on the check, oh, this is hush money payments, so that no one will know that I had this tryst right after the Access Hollywood tape came out.
Now, is Trump going to, he gets Wednesdays off, right?
Yes.
So he can campaign on Wednesdays and he can campaign on the weekends.
Yes.
So if he does a rally, you know, his rallies are like, he's free associates, I think. During those speeches, what are the chances that he is going to say something if he does a rally that the judge will disapprove of? Like 100%?
Pretty not, high, I think.
Not 99.999.
Well, which brings us to what is the punishment for that? And go ahead, Melissa. I'm sorry.
Well, no. He's prone to that. We've seen that, you know, and I think your question is, so what can Judge Merchan do about it? Obviously, he can fine him. Fines don't seem to have a lot of weight with Donald Trump unless they are, you know, really weighty fines.
Could he fine him like $500 million?
That might be viewed as excessive.
Okay.
That might be viewed as excessive. There is also the possibility of criminal contempt, but Andrew and I have talked about this, and you know, we talk about this in the book as well. I think a lot of judges who are in this position, and you know, we've seen this in the civil trials as well, I think they're reluctant to take what might be understood as a nuclear option with Donald Trump because it can be weaponized against them, the judges, and presented as yet another way that Donald Trump is being persecuted by the system. And many of these judges are very reluctant to make a martyr of him, given the ferocity with which his followers engage with him and the way that they direct their ire at those who they believe are persecuting him. And so I think judges are trying to sort of make a delicate balance here, you know, maintaining order in the courtroom, ensuring the safety of jurors and witnesses and courtroom personnel and prosecutors and defense lawyers, but also not going so far that they, you know, gin up a lot of controversy with those who follow him.
Couldn't they give him like home confinement or something like that for the weekend or something like that? I mean, isn't there a something in the middle?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you will see, and there's a pending motion on this, that you will see additional fines. And the next step can be home confinement. It can be essentially like a toddler, a time out in the courthouse where you're sort of taken what's called stepped back into a holding cell so that it doesn't have to be like, you know, a jail sentence of 30 days. So I think there'll be, for the exact reasons that Melissa articulated, it's sort of incremental. but they'll take those steps. I think that what we saw yesterday, which appears to be a very blatant violation with respect to the judge's order saying you cannot make any public statement about a prospective or actual juror, that was raised with the court this morning.
He did a Truth Social post, right?
Yep. That's the kind of thing that my experience in the courtroom is that judges take their obligation with respect to witnesses and particularly jurors incredibly seriously. That is, I think, the kind of thing where you'll take action.
What was the Truth Social thing that he put out? It was repeating something from a Fox News?
Yes, but it was he didn't just repost it. He typed it out and it's and himself in his own posting. And it said that essentially that the prospective jurors are liars. I'm just paraphrasing it.
They're undercover agents or yes. Undercover activists or something like
exactly.
that?
Exactly. And the court's order on March 26 was as clear as day that you cannot make any public statement, truthful or untruthful. It's basically, this topic is off limits. You are to make no statements about jurors. That is something that it'll be interesting to see. Judge Marchand is so careful. He's going to want to make sure that Donald Trump is heard, that his team, you know, has an opportunity to say why this is not a violation. But I would be surprised if there is not action taken that is not just don't do this again.
What is a Sandoval hearing? Is that if Trump testifies, they're going to do a Sandoval hearing?
Yeah. So this is a procedure in New York based on a case called Sandoval. And what it means is if the defendant testifies, he's entitled to know what are the basic other crimes, the other bad acts that he could be cross-examined on. The state has given a list of 13 other cases as to which they would cross-examine him on. By the way, that's in addition to cross-examining him on just lies, which, you know, that could be, I think, if you go by the Washington Post counter, I mean, that's in the thousands.
30,000.
So okay. that's the phone book that will be submitted to Judge Marchand. But this is 13. And it's everything from the E. Jean Carroll verdicts with respect to defamation, with respect to sexual assault, to the recent fraud case.
This is only if he testifies, right?
The Sandoval hearing, if he testifies, yes.
He's not going to testify, is he?
No.
He says he's going to, but I mean, he'd be really stupid to do so.
And the Mueller case, I mean, he said on day one, I can't wait to talk to them. I'm still waiting.
Right. He didn't talk to them. He put in written answers, right?
And not even on everything.
I mean, he didn't answer every question.
Yeah.
Right. And nor would he will answer questions on every topic. I mean, like, we were only allowed to submit questions on certain things and not on other things. So
that's a Shonda.
He said a lot of I'm, of course, I'm willing to talk, and he hasn't. So, you know, yes, he's saying that now. I think there's no way in God's green earth that he is taking the stand. I have to say, if I were the prosecutor, like, the best thing for the case is if he does take the stand. But that's the kind of thing that Susan Nicholas and Todd Blanche know, no way that if they can at all help it, that they're going to have their client take the stand.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court. They're going to be having arguments on immunity, right, next week?
Yes, April 25th. That's right. The last day of the Supreme Court's term.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah, and the rest of it is all them deciding stuff.
It's time for some bad decisions, Al, as it were.
Yes, I'm looking. What are the worst decisions going to be?
There's a lot to choose from. I think the immunity decision may not be a bad one in actual substantive terms, but I do think if the court stalls on it, I mean, if this decision is, you know, finally announced at the end of the term, which is in June, when they finish, then it will have effectively immunized Donald Trump from this criminal prosecution. And what the court actually says about the criminal liability of a president, it will really just be an academic exercise at that point.
Isn't it clear what that is? I mean,
yes,
why did they even take this case? That's a question.
That is a question. There was an opportunity for the court to hear this on an expedited basis. Jack Smith made a motion very early on to bypass the DC circuit and have this heard at the Supreme Court. The court declined to take it up on an expedited basis. It went to the DC circuit. It was argued in January. The DC circuit issued a very comprehensive opinion in February. It took its time, but it was a very comprehensive opinion. And I think it was comprehensive because the DC Circuit, that intermediate appellate court, believed that if they really went through each claim that Donald Trump had offered, every argument, gave it real attention, no matter how specious and stupid some of these claims were, that the court could simply affirm what the DC Circuit had done below and refuse certiorari on this case. The court, of course, did not do that. They waited a fair amount of time before deciding to take it up. They scheduled it for the absolute last day. And, you know, the real question here is,
I didn't realize it was the last day. That is amazing.
Absolute last day.
And last day.
I mean, literally the last possible moment. And again, it raises the question, has the court in participating in Donald Trump's tactics of delay, has it essentially immunized him, even if ultimately the answer to the question will be that no, a president is not immune from criminal liability. By the time they decide that, if they decide it too late, it may be too late for the January 6th election interference trial to go forward.
What is the latest they could do that? I mean, and how long a trial would that be?
So, Andrew, this is a good time to sort of talk about the internal processes in the Department of Justice. I mean, it's an indictment that's sort of built for speed. It only charges a single defendant, Donald Trump, even as it identifies other unindicted co-conspirators. And it's, very tight for charges. It could go very quickly, but you have to account for all of the difficulties of jury selection, the various delay tactics that may be mounted as Donald Trump mounts his defense. So, and then you layer on the complications of a pending campaign and concerns that maybe the Department of Justice does not want to be understood as interfering with the conduct of that campaign by having the trial going on in tandem. This is sort of the question around investigations with Jim Comey and Hillary Clinton in 2016. There's no exact rule about trials that have already been charged, but there may be questions. And I think there would be a lot of sensitivity to the fact of the campaign in process and the election date looming.
So just to turn to the calendar to follow up on sort of Melissa's point, let's say the court issues the decision at the end of June. They wait till the very end of the term and issue a decision. Judge Chutkan, the trial judge, she issued the sort of mandatory stay when there were still 88 days of time that she had given to the defense to prepare between the date of the stay and the date she had initially set the trial, which was March 4th. Just remember, if there had been no stay, if the Supreme Court hadn't gotten engaged, we may have had a verdict in that DC trial already. But if you take those 88 days and you have to kind of add them in, let's assume she continues to do a sort of one-to-one, that means 88 days from the end of June. Even if she shortens that up, and even if Jack Smith, as I think he will, says, you know what, we can tighten the trial, we can get it done in 4 weeks, and sort of keep it streamlined. And I'm sure he's going to do that, this sort of slim to win approach. That really does still bring the case perilously close to the heart of the election season and the issue of whether it's appropriate to have that trial going on at that point. There is the whole issue of even if Donald Trump, if he won, there would be nothing that would prevent Judge Chutkan from having the trial at that point during the interregnum of the date of the election and January 20th. Yeah, that's all down the road. But I mean, the clock is one that is not good for the government because of the Supreme Court's actions. And, there's a way to look at what the Supreme Court's doing as a trifecta, because you had the disqualification decision just this past week. You've had an argument about the obstruction statute, which is one of the statutes that Donald Trump is charged with, where the court seems to be going out of its way to come up with a theory that is not textualist to interpret the statute in a way favorable to the defense and thus favorable to Donald Trump. And now they will have this immunity argument where I completely agree with Melissa, which is it's absolutely clear there's no way in God's green earth that the president can be immune from this case, even in the argument that there might be some small area where a president could be immune in connection with certain activities. It's not going to be this case. This just all looks like the Supreme Court being exceedingly political in its maneuvering on the three cases that affect Donald Trump.
Can I also add, Al, right before the court granted certiorari in this case, they also issued their decision on the disqualification appeal, Trump versus Anderson. And
what is that? Explain that.
Well, the disqualification case was whether Colorado could disqualify its primary ballot. And the court, of course, ruled that it could not, that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment had to be made operative through a provision of Congress, a congressional action. That was ostensibly a unanimous decision, but three justices, the three liberal justices, Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, filed a separate opinion in which they all noted, and it was very striking to me, they essentially referred to Donald Trump, not by his name, but as a, quote, oath-breaking insurrectionist. And they also seemed to gesture at the idea and make notes that the majority was sort of in the bag for Donald Trump, that they were interpreting the Constitution, interpreting these arguments in ways that sought to sequester crucial issues from the court in order to protect this defendant. And the fact that that came out at the same time the court was granting certiorari on the immunity case, to me, spoke volumes. That was the three liberal justices alerting the public to what I think is the view that there are some strong votes for Trump on the other side.
So basically what we're saying is this case that we're talking about today is the one case that will be tried. Probably.
The Manhattan case.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that is, I'd say, a likelihood. Let me give one possibility that we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do, but it is possible that the Supreme Court, in a move to even make sure that this case, the DC case, never sees the light of day before the election, says, you know, we're sending it back so that the trial court has to make a decision about whether the conduct charged is within the president's official duties, what's called the outer perimeter, that's sort of a legal term of art. It's sort of interesting. If they do that, that gives Judge Chutkan the ability to have a hearing on that issue, which could end up being quite a fulsome hearing on, and sort of be her opportunity to give the government an opportunity to address all of those issues, as in other words, the facts of the case with live witnesses. So it remains to be seen what sort of how the Supreme Court plays this and what opportunities it gives.
Well, thank you both for this. I know that the book, again, The Trump Indictments, the historic charging documents with commentary. Congratulations on that. And thank you both for today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Al.
You bet.
Take care.
All right.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.